Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Come November 5th, voters will choose either Democrat Terry McAuliffe or Republican Ken Cuccinelli as Virginia's next governor. But who else is on the ticket for statewide office? I'm Maylily Lee, and today we look at the down-ticket candidates, the men running for lieutenant governor and attorney general. Here's the rundown. On the ballot for lieutenant governor are Democrat Ralph Northam and Republican E.W. Jackson. Running for attorney general are two men named Mark Herring, the Democrat, and Mark Obenshain, the Republican. Here to talk about them and the race for governor are Shellyann Davis, political reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, and Bob Lewis, political reporter for the Associated Press there in Richmond. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And in our Roanoke studio, Professor Harry Wilson, director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
Now, we reached out to the down-ticket candidates, inviting them to call in and introduce themselves to public radio listeners across the state. Mr. Jackson's campaign says he couldn't accommodate us this morning, but hopes to be on the program in coming weeks. Mr. Herring's campaign has not responded. So we welcome Mark Obenshain and Ralph Northam. We'll start with you, Dr. Northam. You are the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, and we welcome you.
Good morning, man. Thank you for having me on the show this morning.
Now, since 2007, you've been state senator for the 6th District, which covers the Eastern Shore, parts of Virginia Beach, Tidewater. You consider yourself fiscally conservative and liberal on social issues. How does that play out for you in a state like Virginia?
Well, I think, you know, I talk to the mainstay of Virginia, the folks that, you know, care about the things that the values and principles I have, jobs and the economy certainly is important. As a pediatric neurologist, I'm a business person. We run a business in our office, and we've been successful. We employ over 250 people presently. And, you know, we've been working on the challenges and issues across the Commonwealth that are important, such as transportation. Health care is obviously my background. I also teach at the medical school, so I'm very involved with education. So, you know, those are the things that we want to continue to work on to make Virginia a great place to live and work.
I want to talk about something that was controversial back in 2009 when you agreed to leave the Democratic State Senate caucus. And thanks to Twitter, there was much attention around that. You decided to back off and not split off from the caucus. Can you give us the background on what led to your initial decision?
Well, first of all, May, there's a lot of misinformation out there regarding that, and there was never discussion about me leaving the caucus. That was about budget negotiations with the Finance Committee, and, you know, I talked to my caucus. I went over and talked to Governor Kane. We were looking at some issues in Hampton Roads, some financing for the medical school here, Eastern Virginia Medical School, the Children's Hospital, and also Old Dominion University. And we had a good discussion. You know, I got what we needed for my district, and we moved on. So, you know, there was a lot going on that morning, a lot of rumors that I was switching parties or leaving the caucus, but it was unfounded, not true. I ran in 2007 as a Democrat. I've been a very loyal Democrat. My fellow senators were very supportive of me, you know, during this primary. And, you know, I'll always be a Democrat. I've worked very hard for the values and principles that we believe in. So a lot of talk, but there was nothing to that.
We can see that when you're down the road, middle of the road, folks like Senator Mark Warner and others who are more moderates, that is, that they can relate to the other side of the aisle, that brings a lot of pluses and a lot of negatives. Has it been difficult for you, or do you think that actually paves the way, that you straddle both parties in a way?
Well, no, I think it's been good, May, because as you know, whenever we pass legislation, you know, it has to be a majority in the House, the Senate, and certainly the governor has to sign on. And I think a good example of that is the smoking ban in restaurants. I, I patroned that bill in 2008. We passed it out of the Senate. It was defeated in the House. We came back the next year in 2009, and we had consensus in both the Senate and House, and Governor Kaine at that time, you know, signed that into to law. So I have a reputation in Richmond of working with both sides of the aisle. As I said earlier, I'm a Democrat, and I certainly work hard for our principles and values, but I'm open to anybody's ideas, whether they're Republican, Independent, or Democrat, and that's the reputation I have, and that's really the way we need to operate in Richmond to move things forward.
Now, when one clicks on your website, we see that one of the big pushes at this time is ethics reform. Talk to us about the genesis of that.
Well, you know, I went to Virginia Military Institute. I was president of the Honor Court there my senior year. I teach medical ethics at the medical school to residents and students. And, you know, we do things a little bit differently in medicine than we do in politics. And I would like to see them the same. We don't accept gifts as physicians, and I think that's the way that it should be. So in 2010, I introduced legislation to put some more teeth in ethics and politics. I was a co-patron with Ward Armstrong at that time, and that would have, I think, made things a lot better for Virginia. And I think it was a visionary move back at that time. It passed out of the Senate, and it was defeated in the House. But here we are again, you know, in 2013 with some very, very serious ethical situations going on in Richmond. And I certainly hope and expect in 2014 session that we'll be dealing with this again. It needs to be dealt with. Virginians deserve better.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ralph Northam, for talking with us this morning. We appreciate your chiming in.
Thank you so much, May.
And back to your patients this morning.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Uh-huh. We also have on the line Mark Obenshain. Good morning to you. How are you, Mark?
I'm great.
Great. Great to have you with us. Since 2004, you've been a state senator from Harrisonburg, and now you have put in your bid to become AG. How does it feel to be, after many, many years behind the scenes, now in a statewide lens?
Well, it's been a great experience for me. I've thoroughly enjoyed representing the Shenandoah Valley in Richmond over the course of the past 10 years, but I grew up in Richmond. I've been in the Shenandoah Valley for a long time practicing law out here, and traveling the Commonwealth of Virginia just really reinforces in me the diversity that we have both in our population, our industry, and our economy here in Virginia. And it's been just a great experience traveling throughout Virginia, talking to Virginians about their concerns, their hopes, and desires for the future.
We talked about Dr. Ralph Northam's background, his vocation. Share with us yours.
You know, I'm running for Attorney General, so it may not come as a great surprise to you that I've practiced law for 26 years. I actually settled in the Valley to join a firm that wound up with about 70 employees. I was managing partner of that firm until about 2002, when I left in order to run for the state Senate. And I went through this experience of leaving that job and starting a new firm from scratch, which I'm proud to say we've grown to a firm in Charlottesville and the Shenandoah Valley. And during that time, I have handled a variety of complex litigation across Virginia and, frankly, across the country as well. What I bring to this race in terms of my professional experience is experience in managing a firm. And the Attorney General's office is, frankly, one of the largest and clearly the most important law firm in Virginia. And I look forward to the opportunities and challenges of representing a complex entity, the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the people of Virginia as its Attorney General and running the people's law firm.
I would like to talk to you about something your opponent, Mark Herring, has brought up and give you a chance to respond. It's about your 2009 proposal that women report miscarriages to the police. Talk to us about how that came about.
Sure. Well, that's not the proposal. What happened, and Mark knows it's not the proposal, and
that's why we're giving you this opportunity.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the question. We had a tragic situation in 2008 in the Shenandoah Valley in which a college student gave birth to a full-term baby and tragically threw that baby in a dumpster. And that baby was never recovered. The Commonwealth's attorney, Marcia Garst, came to me and presented me with a desire to introduce a bill to protect newborn babies, to make sure that if a baby is born that and born dead, that there is an obligation to notify the authorities and to prevent such a situation. In this case, you know, nobody knew whether that baby was born alive or dead. And I introduced this bill at the request of Marcia, and we realized immediately, knew that it was overbroad, and I reached out to groups that I have not traditionally worked closely with, to Planned Parenthood, to NARAL, and asked them for their help to look at this bill, to understand the circumstances. We can all agree that we need to protect newborn babies. And to see whether there was a way that this bill could be amended in order to meet Marcia's situation. It couldn't be. And before there was ever a hearing, before there was a news story, a blog entry, or anything, I had to make that telephone call to Marcia and tell her that this bill would not work because it would carry all kinds of unintended consequences like those that my opponent is trying to take advantage of in this race. I would never request or pursue or advocate a bill that would work that kind of a hardship on mothers who are going through that difficult period.
On some of the matters, such as the transvaginal ultrasound and the parenthood legislation that is giving rights to unborn children, both measures were struck down. These are things that you would support because still you do support the rights of the unborn.
Well, let me be clear. First of all, I am guided by in certain areas by my faith, and I'm pro-life, and I believe in the sanctity of human life, and I would protect innocent human life, but I'm running for attorney general, not running for the legislature. As Attorney General, I'm not going to have the opportunity to make those decisions as to who can have an abortion under what circumstances. That's not the role of the Attorney General. My role as Attorney General of Virginia is to call balls and strikes, to represent the Commonwealth, to defend our laws, to take action to make sure that Virginia is safe, to make sure that Virginia is a great environment for doing business. And frankly, as I travel around Virginia and talk to people, what they want in an attorney general is an attorney general who is focused on the responsibilities of the job, focused on making sure that our communities are safe, making sure that our kids are safe in school, making sure that we're standing up for our right-to-work laws and making sure that Virginia is an environment in which we're continuing to attract and attract jobs and grow and develop a stronger economy.
I'd also like to talk about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. The Supreme Court struck down DOMA, which was a federal law blocking federal recognition of gay marriage. Both you and Mark Herring had differing opinions on this measure. The Supreme Court has stated what it's stated. So as a lawyer, where do you stand now in your opinion of DOMA?
Well, DOMA was a federal law, and when Virginia legislators had an opportunity to address the issue, Mark Herring and I were both in the Senate of Virginia, and both of us voted in favor of the marriage amendment. Both of us voted in favor of sending that amendment to the voters and giving them an opportunity to decide whether that amendment was added to the Constitution of Virginia. And presumably both of us thought at the time that it was constitutional. I continue to think that it's constitutional and that, again, it's not the role of the Attorney General to make those determinations as to whether the marriage amendment will stand or fall. And there has been a suggestion that the ACLU is planning on filing a lawsuit. And one of the jobs of the Attorney General is to defend such lawsuits. And I would defend it because that's my responsibility. Even in situations in which there are laws that pass that I may not agree with, I may find myself in the uncomfortable position of having to defend those laws because that's my job. And that is the job of the Attorney General. And I would hope that both candidates for Attorney General would do their job. In California, we had a situation where Jerry Brown, the Attorney General of California, defaulted on the lawsuit there in California, which raises the question of whether attorneys general ought to substitute their judgment for that of the people and for the legislature. And in this instance, there is a clear path. If somebody wants to repeal the marriage amendment, there's a process by which that can very clearly be accomplished, but it shouldn't be accomplished by default. And I'll do my job.
Now, in our remaining couple of minutes, talk to us about what you see as challenges ahead. I know that you and I have spent quite a number of minutes talking about what a lot of candidates don't want to be talking about, which is the social issues, despite the fact that, of course, you know, the electorate wants to talk about those. But let's give you an opportunity to talk about some bread and butter issues. What do you see as imperative to Virginia?
Well, I appreciate that, and as I travel around the Commonwealth of Virginia, I have to say that what people really want to talk about is what are you going to do to keep our community safe, and what are you going to do to make sure that our economy remains strong. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that I'm partnering with law enforcement to make sure that in our schools our kids are safe and protected from violence, to make sure that they're protected from child predators, to make sure that that drug dealers, repeat drug dealers, wind up spending the time that they ought to spend in prison, and protecting our kids from the threat of gang violence. I also want to make sure that we are protecting against the growing problem of human trafficking in Virginia, which is sadly the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world. And around Virginia, we are seeing some of the consequences of that, and I think that there's a moral imperative for us as Virginians to be leaders in that fight. I also think that we need to make sure that we are taking steps to make sure that our economy remains strong. I'm committed to defending our right-to-work laws in Virginia, and I will do that as Attorney General. I'm also committed to making sure that as we go through this process of reevaluating and the relationship between the states and the federal government, that where the federal government steps over the bounds of its authority, that we push back. And this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue where Democrat attorneys general and Republican attorneys general across the country have stepped up and pushed back. And right now, we've seen an instance in which the administration in Washington is about to impose new regulations on coal-fired power plants that are operating and providing 40% of our power in Virginia. And that's an issue that's going to affect every single ratepayer in the Commonwealth.
And I will say, Mark Obenshain, that's another discussion, and we'd love to talk with you about that as well. A pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you this morning.
Sarah. And you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today we want to welcome WRIR in Richmond to the Virginia Public Radio family. WRIR, broadcasting at 97.3 on the FM dial, added Virginia Conversations to its schedule Wednesday afternoons at 3 o'clock. You can check out all the Virginia Public Radio partner stations carrying Virginia Conversations by visiting our website, virginiapublicradio.org. Today we're discussing the candidates for Virginia's next governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. Our guests are Shelley-Ann Davis, political reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Bob Lewis, political reporter for the Associated Press, and Dr. Harry Wilson, director for the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College. We spoke just recently with Mark Obenshain and with Ralph Northam. Bob Lewis, let's talk a little bit about Mark Herring and Mark Obenshain on DOMA. Did you find it interesting what the, you know, would-be attorney general was talking about on when it comes to Defense of Marriage Act?
Well, to a large extent, I think DOMA is going to set the table for the next attorney general. You can pretty well bank on a lawsuit being filed to challenge the state's marriage amendment. And if that happens, the attorney general has to defend state law. To a large extent, the rulings of the Supreme Court in late June are going to make up a large workload for the next attorney general. And not only is there the Defense of Marriage Act, there's also the Voting Rights Act. The court struck down a major provision of that act, which requires Virginia and other states with a history of discrimination to submit changes in election law to the Justice Department for review. That is no longer that's been struck down. That's no longer operative. So the question is, does Congress reauthorize some form of the Voting Rights Act? And in the meantime, if election law changes are enacted that minorities feel unfairly disposes them, what do they do? Do they just take it straight to federal court? There's no preclearance anymore. So I guess the only remaining option would be to take an action to federal court, and that would obligate the attorney general to defend Virginia law. And I think it's going to be a busy year for either Mark when one of the two inherits the Pocahontas building.
I'm going to toss this out to either you, Dr. Wilson, or to you, Shellyann. McDonald did this. Allen did this. Their campaigns managed to avoid stepping too steeply into the social issues, and they won their candidacies. They were able to broaden their appeal on those, you know, bread and butter issues and not let the social issues prevent them from being elected. You just mentioned, Bob, that the DOMA Act could truly be a pivotal issue for the AG race. So do we see in these down-ticket statewide races the potential that these social issues will prevail?
Well, I will say that in the two down-ticket races, social issues have definitely, I think, dominated the conversation so far. That's partly at the urging of the Democratic candidates, who I think feel that their Republican opponents are very conservative socially and are trying to make, you know, big issues out of that. So I think that the question will be, can Mark Obenshain and E.W. Jackson talk about other issues, you know, break through the Democrats' efforts to only talk about social issues or talk about the Republicans as social issue candidates. I know that, Mark Obenshain, when I hear from him and when I hear campaign planks from him, it really is not about social issues. He does want to talk about, other aspects of being attorney general. E.W. Jackson has been very much in the news for his social positions or his statements on various social issues. And so I think it kind of remains to be seen from him, the other things that he's going to want to talk about.
I would tend to agree with that. I think that the social issues that the lieutenant governor candidates really have certainly not run away from those social issues, particularly in the case of Jackson, that he's sort of embraced those. And Obenshain has tried to downplay that as to some extent or to a large extent as has Ken Cuccinelli running for governor. But I think in the case of attorney general, that it really is more of, Bob's point is very well taken about the issues that are going to dominate probably the first year or maybe even beyond that for whoever is elected AG. But AG is more, I hate to use the word administrative, but it is more of an administrative role and less of a policymaking role in the sense that it is, at least from my perspective, the attorney general's obligation to defend laws, whether they completely agree with them or they don't completely agree with them. And it is less of a – in that sense, it is less of a policymaking position. We may have lost sight of some of that with the current attorney general who's turned it more in – almost into a policymaking position and less into that administrative role.
You mentioned, by the way, E.W. Jackson. the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. He's the minister of Exodus Faith Ministries in Chesapeake, Virginia, graduated with a Harvard Law degree. KKK comes up quite a bit. He says Planned Parenthood has been more dangerous to African Americans than the KKK. He says the LGBT community is more destructive than the KKK. You know, it almost feels like sometimes candidates are reaching toward a specific vein just to energize that particular electorate.
But I think in the case of Jackson, what you've got is a candidate who's out there really talking about what they believe in. And certainly many people are going to disagree with him and disagree with him vehemently. But he is certainly not, I would say, a traditional candidate running for statewide office probably in any state. I mean, he's pretty far outside of that mold. And you know, the playbook certainly for the Republicans this year would be, if I were writing their playbook or anyone else writing their playbook, I think would be try to focus on economic issues. That's really what people are more interested in. And Jackson really has not done that and has not run away from the social issues.
Joseph from Roanoke, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Could you settle a debate for us this morning? Can you settle a debate for us this morning?
Sure.
Is it Roanoke or is it Roanoke?
I say Roanoke.
All right, thank you. What's your question?
Yeah, you asked the question of Mr. Northam, which I thought that needs to be delved in a little bit further about his attempt to change parties. Now, he stated that there was disinformation in the Internet, but didn't tribute on not Larry Sabato covered this issue during the primary. Mr. Northam went a little bit further. He actually was picking out committee assignments. He had actually made commitments to change parties, and it wasn't until a last-minute pressure by the governor and some acquiescence on the parts of the Democrats that he decided to stay. So that's the first issue. The second issue, I'm an African-American Democrat, and after this primary, I don't know who I'm going to vote for. You know, here we are in 2013 with an African-American president, and yet again, we have another all-white ticket put forth by the Virginia Democrats. I think this party needs to move forward and come into the 21st century. I'll hang up and listen.
You know, Joseph brings up an interesting point. I don't know who wants to jump in here, but E.W. Jackson was raised a Democrat. He is an African-American who was raised in this area, raised by a Democratic family, and has since switched and has asked other African-Americans to bail out of the Democratic Party. So Joseph, in a way, is echoing some of these sentiments. Does anybody want to take that?
No.
Okay, we got a no from Bob. Shalian.
I don't.
Got a no from you.
No.
And then let me just make it unanimous. Dr.
It is
Wilson.
What it is.
I think I'll defer.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate your call, Joseph. Thank you for that. We did want to flesh that out, and I appreciate that you did that. On the flip side, when we were talking with Mark Obenshain, it would have been nice to have fleshed out a little bit more around the proposed reporting of miscarriages measure that didn't make it through. He did state his case, but at the time, that is what it was. It was a proposal that would force women to report miscarriages. And as he pointed out, that's not what he intended. So it was an oops moment for him.
And I believe he struck his own bill.
Right. I think that was the point, wasn't it? He realized, oops, this is too far reaching. It's way too broad. Let me rescind this.
I mean, that happens in the legislature when people throw a bill out there and they pretty quickly realize when it sometimes when it goes to the staff level for drafting and then when it works its way through committee that there are fatal flaws with the legislation and they say, well, look, this isn't going to do what we intended it to do, and they'll strike their own bill. And if I recall right, that's what Mark did.
All right, let's move to the issue of who is funding the campaigns. Let's talk specifically about the gubernatorial campaigns. Who are the major donors for each of the candidates, Bob?
Well, I happen to bring a few prepared notes. Okay, the major donors on both sides are their own political parties, their own the Republican Governors Association, Democratic Governors Association. So let's kick those out of the equation. We know that they're going to give and give large to keep their candidate in the game, and actually RGA to this point has given Cuccinelli a little more than DGA has given McAuliffe, but. The story starts to emerge when you look at the other sectors of giving to each candidate. VPAP, the wonderful thing that it is, you can go on VPAP and you can for those of you who don't know what that is, the Virginia Public Access Project, I suggest that you log on at VPAP.org. Yes, David Poole, that's a plug for you.
Our good friend David. He really appreciates that.
If you look at it by industry – Cuccinelli's number one donor by far is energy and natural resources, coal companies. They're giving a lot of money to him, and it's clear why. They really don't like the clean air proposals that the Obama administration has brought forth and that Democrats have seemed to support. Energy and natural resources for McAuliffe ranks number nine. It's just 1% of his total giving as of the last report. Look at the number one giver for McAuliffe outside of politics. Lawyers. McAuliffe's not a lawyer. Cuccinelli is. 11% of McAuliffe's giving came from the law industry. That ranks sixth for Cuccinelli. Finance and insurance was almost exactly the same amount, also 11%. And if you go down to Cuccinelli, it's fourth. There are stories to be had if you look at VPAP. The second largest giver for Cuccinelli is listed as miscellaneous. And that's very interesting because rarely do you see miscellaneous rank that high for a candidate. Then if you look a little closer for Cuccinelli among miscellaneous – you'll see that 74% of those miscellaneous contributions totaling $889,000, 74% of it comes from retirees. Now, that probably indicates that Cuccinelli is appealing to a older audience while maybe McAuliffe is getting younger people. The good thing about the older audience is that older people tend to vote. Younger people, sometimes they come out in big numbers as they did for President Obama. Sometimes they don't. In tricky off-year governor's races like Virginia has, it's really hard to mobilize a young electorate. And so what do all those tea leaves mean? I don't know, but voters will have a chance to decide that in the next 4 months.
Okay. Well, what about the Shellyann, what about these donors and the funds coming in? Bob pointed out some interesting differences. What does this tell us about the tenor of these races versus 4 years ago?
I'm not sure. You know, I don't recall exactly who the donors were 4 years ago. I will say I think that I've noticed that this time around there's definitely a lot more money – or it feels like there's a lot more money coming from the parties. I think there's a lot of attention on this race. Virginia always gets a lot of attention because there's only two governor's races this year in the years when Virginia does its governor's races. And New Jersey this year doesn't have a very exciting race. So I think it's very indicative that this time around Virginia's governor's race is getting a lot of national attention. It's getting a lot of national money. That may be a little bit different from 4 years ago. I can't recall who the top donors were for McDonnell and for Cree Deeds 4 years ago. I wouldn't be surprised to see some coal and energy interest had been high up on the McDonnell list. But I think that the presence of national money is pretty interesting this time around.
Am I missing something? It seems like each race over the years has something memorable. With Gilmore, it's no new car tax. With Allen, it was parole reform. Am I missing something? I'm not hearing any major issue or catchphrase right now.
I think it might take more time for that to sort of shake out. Sometimes these things don't really get going this early. You know, the public's not really paying attention yet. I think that both campaigns are just sort of test driving various issues and points right now. Mm-hmm.
There comes a point in every race when the tempo of it heats up, level of rhetoric heats up, just about the time that people are starting to pay attention. If you look at our races, most of the eureka moments come in the final 2 or 3 month sprint to Election Day. You might remember in 2006 the fateful macaca moment that George Allen had was August 11th. So we're still a good ways out. There's a debate next weekend at the Homestead, and you know those are usually very good debates, but they don't amount to much because the public isn't tuned in yet. The public really starts dialing in September. So the first debate that really every year in and year out, that has made a difference has been the Fairfax Chamber of Commerce debate. And memorable moments there. You can count them every year. But money, people shouldn't get too single-minded about money. Money does not predict who wins and loses. In fact, there have been memorable races in the last 2 or 3 years where the candidate who did not raise the most money won. There are three important elements to any successful race: money, message, and organization. All three have to work hand in hand, and whoever does the best on all three of those wins.
That's Bob Lewis, political reporter for the Associated Press. We're also joined by Shelley Ann Davis of the Fredericksburg Freelance Star and Dr. Harry Wilson of Roanoke College. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder, past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. Find out about upcoming topics on our Facebook page. Like us, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today we're talking about the candidates for statewide office in Virginia, particularly the AG race and the lieutenant governor race. On the ballot for lieutenant governor are Democrat Ralph Northam and Republican E.W. Jackson. Running for attorney general, Mark Herring, Democrat, and Republican Mark Obenshain. And we heard earlier from Obenshain and Northam. Our guests today are Shelley Ann Davis, political reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Bob Lewis, political reporter for the Associated Press, and Dr. Harry Wilson, professor and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College. Turning to you, Dr. Wilson, between the two races, the lieutenant governor race and the attorney general race, which one seems more driven by ideologues?
Well, I think pretty clearly that would be the lieutenant governor's race, although what we've got – I would suggest top to bottom of both tickets, actually, particularly on social issues, which everyone seems to be focusing on, are on the Republican side. We have three pretty strong conservatives on social issues. And on the Democratic side, we have three pretty strong liberals on social issues. So there is a pretty significant difference there, even if neither side sometimes wants to talk about those issues, or one side certainly more than the other. In the case of the lieutenant governor's race, obviously with Mr. Jackson, he is what I would refer to as sort of more of an amateur campaigner. Amateur in a sense, of course, yes, he's run for the Republican nomination for Senate a couple of years ago unsuccessfully. But he is not a politician in the sense of being a politician. And people can look at that as a positive or as a negative. But I think that comes through a lot in sort of clearly in not just what he says but how he says it. That he really is much in that sense much more of a minister and sort of the slogan on his slogan, Unite and Inspire. That's as much as coming from a minister as it is coming from someone running for lieutenant governor.
And what about the AG race?
The AG race, I think certainly more of an emphasis on what we heard from Mark Obenshain today is certainly more of an emphasis on sort of what the attorney general actually does. And as a political scientist, I'm kind of happy to hear attorney general candidates sometimes actually talk about what attorney generals do, because all too often I think they're actually pretending as if they're running for governor, and those are very different positions with very different responsibilities.
And could I just interject there? Often they become the governor.
Often they do become the governor. So I would not say your point is very well taken there. I would not say we should ignore social issues or anything like that, because often they do become governor, and whoever is elected attorney general most certainly would run for higher office down the road.
Okay. Do you want to chime in there, Bob or Shelian?
I think what we're seeing right now, to go back to what you were talking about, and I don't think I really gave you an answer a minute ago, what the two candidates in the governor's race are doing right now. Right now, they're like two boxers testing each other's character and credibility. If you look at the daily barrage of emails each campaign sends, that's what it's all about. McAuliffe is incessantly trying to hammer Cuccinelli over his ties to Johnny Williams and Star Scientific and the gifts that he received and reported late. And then Cuccinelli is constantly hammering McAuliffe over his business ventures and green tech automotive and the pellet factory and stuff like that. The subtext of it is each is telling the electorate this guy can't be trusted. They've had policy rollouts. Each side has, but right now the theme continues to be, which guy do you trust the most? And that's where they are at this point. Shelian.
Yes, Shelian.
I would totally agree with Bob on that. I mean, I think we're just seeing both of them, you know, sort of throwing everything that they can at the other one to see what sticks. And I feel like they're sort of testing the waters on a lot of these accusations to see what has legs, see, you know, where things go, and probably practicing some of their messages for the fall when the broader electorate is paying attention.
We listened to Ralph Northam earlier, Lieutenant Governor, Democratic Lieutenant Governor, talking about his ethics reform proposal. And it was interesting when he framed it this way. He said, back in 2010, I was pushing for ethics reform. This is really interesting given that, in a way, his ethics reform push or his message feels like a direct response to the Star Scientific issue.
Sure it is.
And so here we have something that's maybe opportunistic, shall we call it that?
Well, I'm a little amused when I hear legislators clamoring for more transparency, for ethics reform. Absolutely, we need it. Survey after survey ranks Virginia's financial disclosure laws, its ethics reporting laws for public officials, among the worst and the most opaque in the country. And now we're getting a real good tutorial on where it fails. I mean, you can receive your family can receive a $15,000 gift, and yet it's not reportable. If they were as genuinely concerned about transparency in government, then maybe we wouldn't have seen legislation passed this year and signed into law that exempts from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act all emails by legislators and their staffs. We wouldn't see legislation this year that just went into effect at the first of this month that exempts from disclosure under Freedom of Information all records regarding the Department of Aviation. You know what that is? That's the governor's airplane, the governor's helicopter. We can't see where they take trips anymore. So, you know, the crocodile tears don't play much on me. And I find it very amusing, this hue and cry for reforming ethics, when this year we saw a lot of government that people should be able to witness put behind a curtain.
We have a call from Margaret from Hampton. Good morning.
Hi. I just have a comment. This may appear to be a little off the subject, but talking about funding, I saw the first ad last night supported by Americans for Prosperity, a very emotional thing against Obamacare. And I believe this organization is supported by the Koch brothers, who were very active in the last national campaign for the Republicans.
And your question around that?
There's no question. You were talking about funding, and I just want to comment that I think the national funding is going to be a huge issue this fall, and it's beginning now with these television appeals supported by big political or big economic interests.
Good point, caller, and a lot of that's going to go on because Americans for Prosperity and, you know, Crossroads in last year's election, Crossroads GPS, organizations like that don't necessarily have to tell you who their donors are. You don't find out who's behind these advertisements in some cases because they're not political organizations. They're organized as nonprofits. They're 501 organizations. And so they don't have to report their donors the way a political action committee would have to. You don't get to see where the money's coming from. Good point, caller, and get ready. I'm sure you're going to see a lot more. Susan B. Anthony List is another organization that has promised to come to Ken Cuccinelli's aid in a big way, so you may see some stuff from that starting up as we roll into the fall. But very observant, and she's got a good point.
And we all have to brace this fall for television saturation. We certainly endured it just this past fall in the senatorial race.
Yeah, we're going to be inundated once again with ads. And sort of getting back to the message testing. As someone who does polls myself, I was intrigued. Probably about 2 months ago, I got a phone call for a lengthy survey, and it was probably about 30 minutes, which was nothing but message testing. And it was clearly one of the candidates, but I was not able – to their credit, I was not able to figure out which one it was. But it was clearly one of the candidates, and I would say probably 80% of the messages that were being tested were negative messages. And they were negative about each candidate. So it would be kind of like, what's the worst thing we can say about – Ken Cuccinelli, and then what's the worst thing we can say about Terry McAuliffe? And they were testing all of those things out about how people, you know, about did it make you more likely, less likely to vote for that person. So the messages are being tested sort of in polling right now, and I'm sure in focus groups. And they're also obviously, you know, as Bob and Shailen have pointed out, they're also being tested out there right now on the campaign trail, what they're saying about one another.
Keep coming with the calls. 866-611-NEWS is our number. That's 866-611-6397. Anyone here listen to or read the transcripts from the Attorney General debate between the two Marks? Okay.
Sorry, I was out of town.
All right. I just want to check to make sure. Line two, we have Michael from Roanoke. Good morning to you, Michael.
So kind of you to have me. And this is a wonderful show, gives us an opportunity to learn some things we don't always from the news. You're in this wonderful position to steer the conversation with these candidates, you know, kind of like a buyer on the lot with a vehicle you feel wary about. Yes, we do talk. We tire of listening about social issues. Admittedly, the candidates pick and choose how directly they reference them. You know, maybe in lieu of speaking to them, y'all can maybe give us some insights on a couple of things. Like for the lieutenant governor, you know, what are some things that they are speaking about or have referenced to attract jobs to the state? Do they have any positions about reorienting, getting revenue into the state? Like this recent proposal to get rid of the gas tax seems like it's going to dump more of the cost upon Virginians versus some of those other folks that use our roads. And maybe, you know, the issue of how do they feel about getting the insurance companies to provide products for the health exchanges versus the de facto position, which seems like it's going to tilt things in the way of, you know, having a single provider of insurance products.
Michael, you sound like a political analyst. Where are you leaning on these candidacies?
Well, I think that you have nailed it on the head that sometimes they're a bit oblique about speaking about these issues. And where you provide such a wonderful service is that you can steer the conversation a little bit to get them to speak up a little bit more about it.
I take that back. You sound less like a political analyst and more like a public relations person for NPR.
Well, if it's any help, I'm a graduate of the College of Women, Mary in government, but I've ended up in the healthcare field, so let's just say may have a little bit broader horizon.
Great. Well, who are you voting for?
Candidates that want to speak about social issues, I'm a little bit less inclined to vote for. You know, I'd be happy to not worry about party labels so far if I can get a stronger feeling than I did from the last election that they have a very strong ideological focus, and that may blind them from having a broader vision of helping all of Virginia's candidates.
And maybe rather than ask you who you're voting for, what's going to drive you to the polls? A social issue or two, or a different, maybe perhaps economic issue?
That's a great question.
For you personally, Michael.
I would like to say that, you know, I appreciate people with values because that steers your actions. But if your values steer you into positions that are maybe contradictory with a broader religious tradition, it kind of scares me a little bit. And if you're too narrowly focused on one specific industry, you know, I think it ignores the fact that Virginians have many different skills and that lots of parts of Virginia, like Roanoke, you know, may need development and they may need opportunities in different areas to, you know, begin growing a little bit more. So I'm looking for values, but I'm looking for more specific policies to turn that into, you know, reality for our state in the future.
Michael from Roanoke, we appreciate your call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, first thing I should do is congratulate the caller, Michael. I think Michael should be running for public office instead of just calling into these programs. He handled those questions extremely well, I thought. Just a couple of quick points. One example, he talked about some other issues. You know, all three Democratic candidates, or at least McCall, claims that he would have supported the transportation issue had he been in the legislature with the transportation bill. But Northam and Herring both voted for it. Obenchain voted against that transportation bill, and clearly I think Jackson would have as well. Jackson's pretty clearly – we've only talked about his social issues, but he is pretty clearly a small government, lower taxes. This is his prescription for economic issues. So he's pretty clearly fitting into that sort of small government Republican mold.
Okay. And if I could jump in to make a couple of points also about the caller's questions. You know, talk about the lieutenant governor's role. Current Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling has done a lot of focus on economic development and jobs. It's a part-time position, so he sort of carved out this, you know, jobs and economic development role. I have not heard a lot about that from either of the current candidates, whether they would like to continue that sort of role or not. And on the healthcare side, I have heard from Northam. You know, he points out that he's a doctor. He supports expanding Medicaid in Virginia under the Affordable Care Act. I'm not entirely sure where Jackson stands on that. My guess would be he doesn't support that. But, you know, those are issues that haven't come up a lot but are, you know, valid issues in the lieutenant governor's race.
Okay. Bob?
I'm just sitting here listening to Shelian's voice, and I just think it's like butter. Doesn't she have a wonderful radio voice?
That's why she keeps coming back.
It's just beautiful. I could listen to it all day.
Thanks. I think
really there has been not much reporting on the down ticket races by anybody because of a couple of factors. One is the press corps is smaller than it's ever been. Newspapers or television stations have had a hard time the last few years, and they've cut back. Another thing is there's a little bit of news at the top of the ticket and in the executive mansion right now that sort of preoccupied us all. So we haven't really had the chance to delve into LG and AG races the way we used to in the way we should. So I don't know what's going to happen going forward with Governor McDonnell or with wherever this takes us in the current race. But it's preoccupied the media for sure.
I want to thank you so much for this program. We hope to have Mark Herring and E.W. Jackson on in the future. That's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, Bob Lewis, Associated Press reporter, Shellyann Davis, Fredericksburg Freelance Star reporter, and Dr. Harry Wilson of Roanoke College. And thanks to you for listening and joining in today's conversation. Next Friday at 9, fighting litter and fueling recycling in Virginia. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.